supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight.
Back to school.
For the 130,000 kids in the school district of Philadelphia, school is back in session today. The district itself is also back from the brink of a financial meltdown. There are even signs of academic progress. But as WHYY's Avi Wolfman Aaron tells us, challenges remain.
The first day of school, a time to show off what's on your feet.
New Balancers.
Jordan.
Karachis.
Phones. I got the bank phones.
Who is on your backpack?
Spider-Man.
Black Panther.
Elsa and Anna.
That's who?
Elsa and Anna.
And of course, to get pumped for the year ahead.
I'm excited to see my friends.
Hi, Oriana.
Trinaya Bailey-Jones is more than ready for her first grade year at William Dick School in North Philadelphia. She spent all summer reading.
A lot of Cat in the Hat books.
Early literacy is one of the areas where the district says it's making inroads. Although about two-thirds of Philly kids still don't read on grade level by third grade, that number actually improved significantly last year. When this year's state test scores are released publicly, District Superintendent William Height expects to see more progress.
The whole trend is moving forward. These are not just blips.
Height is also optimistic about the city's new Board of Education, which recently replaced the state-controlled SRC. He likes the idea of so-called local control, but offers a warning.
I think the challenges that the board will face are no different than the challenges that the SRC face, because neither group has taxing authority.
That means the state and city still have to provide the bulk of the money. Right now, though, money isn't an issue. The district has a rare window of fiscal stability that should last through at least the middle of 2021. Philly teachers also have a contract, something they went without during the worst years of the district's recent fiscal crisis.
Each year feels better.
But another crisis emerged earlier this year when the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News reported on environmental hazards in city classrooms. The district is furiously trying to remove lead paint in over 40 schools.
These are comprehensive projects that will take some time, and we are working to finish all of those projects by the end of the school year.
It is a work in progress, and some might say the same for Pennsylvania's largest school district. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
The J-1 visa is often used to bring foreign workers to jobs at the Jersey Shore or at summer camps. But among the 300,000 active visas, about 11,000 belong to medical residents who work and train in U.S. hospitals. More than 1,000 of them are in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, often specializing in high-need areas like internal medicine and pediatrics. In an era of travel bans and tougher immigration policies, some administrators worry whether they can keep depending on J-1 visas to fill these jobs. For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg reports.
Anna Midlovska is in her second year of a seven-year surgery residency at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania.
Most of the night, you just keep going for 24 hours without sleeping, so your body is drained, but also this is why I think people who end up in surgery and decided they want to do surgery, like, they are fully aware that this is the life that they're going to have for the next 7 years.
She was a professional tennis player who graduated at the top of her class at Wake Forest University, then attended medical school back home in Poland. After earning top marks, she applied to train as a medical resident through the J-1 visa, and then was matched with Penn. She says surgery requires her full attention, but her visa is a close second.
You are committing yourself to a lot of stress going through the entire process, and some people just don't want to go through all of it, even though they are exceptional, and they decide to just stay in their home countries or go to Great Britain.
Midlovska is not unusual. Stacy Smith, the vice chair for education at Lehigh Valley Health Network in Allentown, says across the U.S., healthcare depends on international trainees like her.
You know, just as an example, with internal medicine, we need probably 7,000 trainees in internal medicine each year, yet our medical schools only produce 18,000 graduates total for all of the specialties. So there's no way we can ever have enough people to fill those spots. So we rely probably on 50% of our spots being filled by international medical graduates.
He says residents who are vetted through J-1 are especially nice for hospitals in hard-to-recruit areas like Allentown. Lehigh Valley relies on about 60 new J-1 trainees a year. Not as many as Penn, but a relatively high percentage.
In a way, it's a luxury being able to take visa applicants because you're able to cherry-pick some of the most talented candidates from a multitude of different countries. And you can pick people with top board scores, top experiences, top skills that really actually add some robust educational experience to our current training program.
The J-1 is not a work visa. It is a temporary cultural exchange program coordinated by the State Department and consulates around the world. For medical residents, the vetting process involves the CIA and a finance check, as well as a letter from the candidate's home country saying it is in need of the specialty they will train in. The maximum stay is 7 years. William Pinsky is president of the Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates, the agency that certifies and recruits future doctors through J-1. He says the Trump administration's immigration policies have weakened the program.
Decisions could be made not understanding what the impact would be for health care.
And Smith says federal policies, travel bans or otherwise, are affecting which applicants they select for Allentown.
I think what's going to happen is now we're deferring or looking over a lot of these applications because they come from countries where we know they're going to have problems with immigration, and we're settling or choosing other candidates that aren't as talented.
At Penn, Midlovsko's surgical residency is a series of one-year contracts, which means she needs to go to Poland to renew her visa. She says even though she's from a country that's relatively easy with immigration, there's still a lot of uncertainty.
They might say that, sorry, we are not giving it to you this year, and you don't really know if everything's going to happen on time and you'll be able to come back and start your next year. And, you know, I can't even imagine how stressful it is for people who come from the countries where there is active conflict.
She says her goal is to further her training in trauma surgery by serving in the U.S. military. That is, if her J-1 goes smoothly and she successfully applies for a different kind of visa. But if it works out, she says all that extra paperwork would be worth it.
I treat this country as my home. So knowing that in 7 years, I'll once again gonna pack my things and go back or go somewhere else, it is a weird feeling to have in the back of my head.
One quarter of all trainees working in U.S. hospitals went to medical school abroad. Yet in the past year, hundreds fewer people applied for the J-1 program. Pinsky says it's unclear how they'll fill all the spots in the long run if the trend continues. For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg.
Despite few obvious signs of progress, Mayor Jim Kenney's $500 million rebuild initiative targeting libraries, parks, playgrounds, and rec centers in Philadelphia is underway. Joining me with an update is Planned Philly reporter Malcolm Burnley. His recent article on the topic is entitled, Mostly Behind the Scenes, the Work of Rebuild Begins. Malcolm, welcome back to Newsworks tonight.
Thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
When the mayor envisioned this project, what was the need initially, or how great was the need initially?
Absolutely. So the need in Philadelphia was particularly dire. Over the last several decades, it's actually kind of been a slope downwards for in terms of funding for parks, recreation centers, libraries, essentially all of those public assets. It really began way back in the 80s during a lot of the federal government funding cuts back during the Reagan times, and then it's just never really been able to be built back up. And then we obviously had the more recent recession. So comparative to other cities, Philadelphia spends significantly less per capita on those public assets. And so in some cases, it's almost half as little, I should say, as other major cities. So the need has been building for years and years. And so that was both, I guess, the aspiration for rebuild was that not only to upgrade these public facilities, but to also try to inject equity back into some of these neighborhoods that have been neglected.
That need is all the more compelling in the context that in the 80s and 90s, Philadelphia was still experiencing a population decline. So that per capita number would, if anything, be enhanced. But you're saying no.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually a really interesting point, because the universe of rec centers, just to take one, as well as libraries in Philadelphia, is actually really vast. I mean, you know, dating back to when our population was much bigger. And so now, especially with the population increase and just the way neighborhoods have changed, there were a lot of facilities that are either trying to be reopened or that basically just kind of sat there in not vacancy, but in, with relatively little use for years and years, that are now population centers that need those resources. So I think that's also part of the impetus for the project.
So what accounted for the delay?
So largely, the line from the Kenney administration has been that the Philadelphia beverage tax has held up rebuild. So it was originally announced in early 2016. And a key portion of the revenue for rebuild was attached to the beverage tax. So the fact that the beverage tax was held up in court, which was challenged all the way up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, has held up that portion of the funding, which allows the administration to borrow more money for rebuild. It's important to say that it was the Kenney administration's decision to tie rebuild to the beverage tax. So critics have also been, you know, somewhat skeptical just of the choice to tie it to the beverage tax to begin with. But as a result of doing that and a result of the lawsuit challenging the beverage tax, that's a large reason why there's been such a delay.
Now that that's resolved, are the floodgates going to open?
Yes and no. So the plan for rebuild is that the majority of the money is going to be raised publicly through issuing bonds, $300 million. In total, the project, with combined with philanthropic dollars and private donations, should be about $500 million. So the first $100 million, by the end of 2018, by the end of the calendar year of 2018, the first $100 million will be available, according to the administration. In the meantime, though, they're only going to be able to start kind of the community engagement portions and some of the asking neighborhoods essentially what they want their rec centers, libraries, parks, and playgrounds to look like. The actual construction won't be happening until 2019.
And what's entailed with the contracting process?
So the contracting process, and it's actually interesting because the terminology is kind of important here. So the way Rebuild is set up is that essentially for any rec center that is selected, any rec center, library, park, playground, let's take Vare Recreation Center and Point Breeze, for example. There's going to be a nonprofit who is going to be overseeing essentially the project manager for that site. So it's actually technically they're going to be getting grants. So they're going to be applied to get a grant to be the project manager for that site. Then they will be managing the money and subcontracting that out to smaller companies to actually do the construction work, to do the smaller bits within at Vare, say, for example.
Putting the more minor projects aside, what might Philadelphia residents or visitors or workers first see as an example of this money being spent?
So how they've described it is they want to be really thoughtful, and by they I mean the Kenney administration, want to be very thoughtful in reaching out to residents, stakeholders, to ask what not only what infrastructure-wise they would want, but try to also imagine, I guess, more broadly what could go, fit into a library or rec center. So even if it's something that the community needs, say, whether it's, I don't know if it'll go as far as a health clinic, but business support services, some other social service, housing it within the rec center or the library, trying to take the input from the community and incorporating that into the design process. That being said, the fact that they haven't been able to articulate to a degree what it's specifically going to look like, I think has also frustrated some people. So it's a double-edged sword. The fact that they're going to be gathering input and hope to shape this based on what the community is telling them, but because of that, they also don't know specifically what, you know, a given upgrade is going to look like.
7 years is longer than Mayor Kenney's term. He could get reelected, but if he were not to be, might that then diminish some of the lofty goals of the program?
That's actually a really interesting question. I mean, when Rebuild was initially announced, it was in within the first 2 years of his administration. And, you know, I think the plan was that there was going to be all these projects getting rolled out. Politically speaking, you know, there's nothing probably better for to help constituents or at least make good favor with constituents than a new building in your neighborhood. So the fact that this has been delayed this long, it is going to be an interesting point going into next year's reelection season. People have been hearing about Rebuild for, you know, years at this point. And you ask around and a lot of people are questioning, well, when's it actually going to come? Some neighborhoods might be reached by then, but I think a lot of neighborhoods probably won't.
Playgrounds and a little bit of politics, too.
Absolutely. Playground politics.
Malcolm, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Malcolm Burnley, Planned Philly reporter. His article is entitled, Mostly Behind the Scenes, The Work of Rebuild Begins. The Dixie Hummingbirds have reached an unprecedented milestone, 90 years of singing gospel music. The Philadelphia-based Grammy winners will celebrate with a year-long series of events throughout the city. WHYY's Annette John Hall reports the celebration is getting a boost from one of the group's biggest fans, who just called to say he loved them.
R&B legend Stevie Wonder had just finished two shows in Atlantic City over the weekend and couldn't make the press conference in person. But he did call in to share his first remembrances of the Hummingbirds, listening to them with his mother on Detroit's AM gospel station when he was a youngster.
Along with hearing the Dixie Hummingbirds, I would hear the Staple Singers, would hear Aretha Franklin at her father's church singing songs. So it's just a great thing to acknowledge.
Lead singer Ira Tucker Sr. was a Hummingbird for 70 years before his death in 2008. His son, Ira Tucker Jr., leads the group now, and he says the spirit of music has sustained them.
And as different members of the group left, others replaced them, they came in with the same feeling and with the same drive. That's what kept the group going for all of these years. That's what keeps us going now.
The anniversary celebration will kick off with a free concert at World Cafe Live on Wednesday. Annette John Hall, WHYY News.
This time last summer, lucky stargazers were swapping stories about their close encounters with a coast-to-coast total solar eclipse. Let's look back and then ahead with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. And Derek, if I recall, you were among the lucky, 150 million plus Americans and others who took in this wonderful sight.
Just a few of us who decided to look up that day. You might categorize this event as the most watched astronomical event ever.
Now, the luck comes in finding a spot that happened to be clear overhead that day.
Right, and that's always a tricky situation. If you look at the path of totality across the United States from the West Coast all the way down to the southwestern portion of the United States, there were varying degrees of success in observing. Some of the locations that were deemed to be the best locations with the least possibility of rain had the largest amount of clouds and things of that nature. But at the same time, this event was carried so broadly that there was no way you could miss seeing some portion of the experience in a cloudless condition.
But for those who did miss it, when's the next opportunity?
Well, the cool thing is that there's another total solar eclipse that will traverse the United States, this time going from south to north, generally speaking, in 2024. That will be April 8th. So on that date, it's anticipated that even more people than the 154 million estimated to have seen last year's eclipse will take a chance on seeing this next one coming up.
Do the special solar specs get stale in the interim?
So this is one of the cool things about the solar eclipse glasses. Although they're billed as solar eclipse glasses, ostensibly for observing solar eclipses, they really are good for observing the sun at any time as long as they're well cared for. And this means that they aren't scratched, it's not punctured, anything like that that would really ruin the integrity of its capability to protect your eyesight. So these glasses that you may have procured for the last eclipse are good for observing the sun now and will be good for the solar eclipse coming up in 2024.
So from an incredible sight to hearing the moon like you've never heard it before.
Yes, yes. I discovered this just recently, that a visual artist working at NASA's Science Visualization Studios at Goddard Space Flight Center had put together just a beautiful complement to Debussy's classic piano composition, Clair de Lune. Now, Clair de Lune was written in the early portion of the 20th century. But Claire de Lune and the moon really don't come together in terms of our ability to explore the surface of the moon up close to this musical background until just now, when Ernie Wright puts the two together in this wonderful collection of images that were gathered by the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's been orbiting the moon since 2009, taking high-resolution images of the surface of the moon and mapping the moon like it hasn't been mapped before, actually.
You can check it out on YouTube as I did, and then what wonderful comments. Among them, this: science and technology can be tools for discovering great beauty in the universe, and play it again, Claude.
Yes, and the moon looks so good, you'll want to observe this over and over again.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Fitz, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.